Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry Truman, Bernard M. Baruch, Senator Robert Taft, General George C. Marshall, Governor Earl Warren, Mary Martin, H.C.O. Pienza, Harold Stassen, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 23rd performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
People in Asia are dying of hunger, and the best-selling books in America are How to Get Thin.
It is with tremendous pride and with unbounded appreciation of his valor and his love of country that I present to you the world's greatest statesman and the next president of the United States.
Sometimes you wonder if you'll ever get home again. And then it happens. You're home. Your wife, your baby, everything you've been wanting, suddenly it's real. It's yours.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for air based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
The nation's writing arm and the post office were still overtaxed. The letters to the editor, to your congressman, to the president, had in the 5 weeks since MacArthur's dismissal broken all records. Even the most addressed man in the world told of the huge stacks that awaited him at the White House every day.
You see things in the paper, write your president, and I get 40,000 letters a day. As a result of that, on special occasions...
Beginning, most congressmen, editors, and commentators reported that the pro-MacArthur mail far outweighed the pro-Truman mail. This week at the annual dinner of the Overseas Press Club, two editors with no little unanswered mail reported on the trend of their most recent letters. First, Mrs. Helen Rogers Reed of the New York Herald Tribune.
Perhaps a slight barometer of thinking in and near New York on the great debate would be through the mail received by one newspaper. Emotion was at white heat, of course, and the ratio of letters received in favor of General MacArthur started at 30 to 1. It went down to 3 to 1 and has been decreasing until it's nearing parity now.
H.V. Kaltenborn reported on his mail.
I think we've all had the experience that the MacArthur mail was almost unanimous in his favor at the beginning and then dropped off. Until now, it's much closer to parity, although I must say that my experience is still that my mail runs at least 20 to 1 in MacArthur's favor.
At the Overseas Press Club dinner were many of the top editors and reporters of every field of journalism. They, like most Americans, spent a large part of the evening arguing about the great dismissal. Hal Boyle of the Associated Press, who spent most of the past 11 months on the Korean front, said this.
It's a distinguished friend of mine from the New York Times, a gentleman from the New York Times, Washington Bureau, said the current quip in Washington is about the old soldier fading away. He's not fading away. He's just fading and fading and waiting till he can get the dice again.
Gideon Seymour of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune said he spoke for the people of the Midwest.
Now, the people of the Middle West realize that in this long struggle, Korea is only an incident, albeit an important incident. They want an American foreign policy that is a world policy, not just a European policy, and certainly not just an Asiatic policy. They have felt that the administration wrote off too casually, almost even eagerly, our vital interests in Asia and the Pacific. They have welcomed the MacArthur tumult because it has stiffened the administration's resolve to protect our Asiatic interests. And to re-examine what those interests are. They don't think MacArthur is right, but they think that he has impelled correction of a tendency to make too easy concessions to communism in Asia.
And Barry Bingham of the Louisville Courier-Journal and Times said that he spoke for the people of the South.
There is plenty of MacArthur sentiment in the South today. Yet when I studied the press recently to see the reaction to the firing episode, I found somewhat more support for the administration in Southern papers than in the press generally. The South, I think, is a little less subject to mass hysteria than the rest of our nation. We have fewer people in the South who believe that America can live alone and go on living at all.
Bob Considine of International News Service, author of a book called MacArthur the Magnificent, said this.
We all hear the great debate. There's no more great debate. The administration has come around to MacArthur's thinking very vividly, I think. There's no great differentiation. There's no great cleavage anymore. Marshall said yesterday that he certainly believed in saving Formosa. The day after MacArthur got back, we sent a team of experts to Chiang Kai-shek to train those guys. The British, at great sacrifice, have stopped selling rubber to Red China, which is a part of the general blockade that he had called for. But it seems to me that in these 300,000 or 400,000 words that have been said, the boys have finally talked themselves into the same point of view.
And author and editor Quentin Reynolds, who said he had never met Truman or MacArthur, had this theory.
I don't think General MacArthur needs any defense from his enemies, heavens knows. But I do think he needs a defense against some of his friends. I mean the idolatrous supporters who surrounded him during the past few years, who attribute to him all the wisdom and virtue under the sun without any of the faults which ordinary human flesh is heir to. Now, if you tell one of these men, and we've all met the members of the general's staff, that General MacArthur is really human, and if he's cut, he actually will bleed, they rise in indignation and say, you're smearing the greatest warrior that ever lived. If you grant General MacArthur's great personal courage, and only a fool would say nay to that, and if you grant his competence as an officer to them, they say indignantly that you're belittling him. I think General MacArthur's greatest enemies are those who purport to speak for him these days, especially those in Washington.
The gentlemen of the press and radio were perhaps a bit more articulate, but able to reach no more definite conclusions than any of the 700 people assembled in the same room. Actually, the only definite conclusion reached was that an ancient political proverb quoted by editor Gideon Seymour from Minneapolis made enough sense to be requoted twice during the evening.
Fisher Ames, congressman from Massachusetts, date 1794. A monarchy is like a merchant ship. It sails the seas proudly, but if it strikes a rock, it will sink. A republic is like a raft. It will never go down with you, but your feet are always wet.
The raft was rocking in the Senate caucus room this week. The senators looking into the MacArthur case spent more than 2 days debating a constitutional issue. Does a confidential advisor to the president have to tell Congress about his confidential talks with the president? The advisor was General Omar Bradley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On Monday, he told the senators that General MacArthur's plans for Asia would involve us in the wrong war, at the wrong place, at the wrong time, and with the wrong enemy. Then, General Bradley refused to tell the committee what went on at the White House discussions on dismissing MacArthur. The senators argued and then voted, 18-8, to let General Bradley keep his talks with the president a secret. Republican Senator Noland of California was unhappy over the decision.
There is grave danger that the action taken by the committees today will present the committee with an iron curtain blocking off certain information which they will need in order to discharge their duty to the Senate and to the nation. If this precedent holds with other witnesses, it is entirely possible that the same defense will be made relative to the Yalta Conference, the Potsdam Conference, and the meetings in the Blair House which led up to this country being committed to the Korean War. Certainly, this question of a confidential relationship, if carried to that extreme, will block the Senate and the country from having information which they need to arrive at sound conclusions.
But Republican Senator Flanders of Vermont doesn't think the committee set any precedent for the future.
It was difficult to decide what was the right thing on this vote. I stated that I would not want to be a party to setting new precedents which would weaken the authority of Congress to get needed information. I became assured that we could still be insistent on other occasions in this hearing. The trouble in making the fight on this instance is that the relation between General Bradley and the President is, by law, a confidential one. The same conditions will not apply to the other witnesses who will come before us.
And Chairman Russell, a Democrat, was pleased at the support the committee had given him.
I think that the decision of the committee is eminently correct, not only because I made the decision, but because it is supported by the great weight of constitutional authority. These issues are important, more important than the individuals who happen to occupy offices now, because if any one branch of the government obtains an undue advantage over another and is able to impinge upon its rights, it threatens our wonderful system and our fundamental freedoms.
The committee invited General Bradley to return to the witness chair on Monday, and then the president made it known he had been considering dismissing General MacArthur since last August. It was no hasty decision, and Secretary of State Acheson had originally opposed the move on the grounds it would kick up a political fuss. Mr. Truman acknowledged the firing of MacArthur had done that. You hear is a hymn being sung by the Corps of Cadets of the Virginia Military Institute as they honored their most illustrious graduate, the Secretary of Defense George Catlett Marshall. For the general, it was undoubtedly a welcome respite after more than 7 days on the witness stand before the joint committees. He spoke of confusions and a free press.
What a tremendous development has taken place, and how confused, as they often say, the public is. You can't move at that speed without some confusion, and you certainly can't move at that speed with a free press without considerable confusion. Now, understand me, I'm in no way reflecting on a free press. That's a vital necessity in this country, but it touches your vitals every now and then.
Also on the platform at VMI was elder statesman Bernard M. Baruch, an old friend of General MacArthur as well as General Marshall, but who has broken with President Truman. To date, Mr. Baruch had not indicated his position on the controversy, but on Tuesday, he left little doubt as to where he stood.
I wonder how much of the controversy in recent days is really a reflection of the difference between the leader of troops and the organizer. A great leader of troops, naturally, is zealous in desiring that when his men become locked in battle, that every resource be marshaled which might increase the chance of their winning or of decreasing their losses. The very qualities which made him so valiant a leader of troops would make him impatient of any limitations on his action. But the organizer has to think not only of the men fighting in the one front, but of all the fronts of war and defense. He must weigh each theater and its relative importance upon the scales of a globe-flung strategy. Today, as Secretary of Defense, George Marshall, perhaps under even more difficult conditions, is called upon to devise the global strategy which will bring us victory in the peacemaking.
Later, Mr. Baruch, who has been right as often as most men who make public pronouncements, suggested a solution for this controversy.
Many of the issues and choices raised by the controversy would solve themselves if more of America's strength were mobilized. Until we have mobilized, few, if any, of the issues have been raised can really be solved. There is strength in unity, but there's also unity in strength. We, our allies, as well as this country, must first grow stronger militarily before we can have a unified foreign policy. In Korea, today we are buying time. No, it is not we who are buying time. It is our young men who are buying the time for the whole free world to rearm. Are we doing as much as we possibly can with this time, as quickly as we can? That is the question we all should be asking ourselves. What are we doing with the time being bought for us at so great a price? I would be less than frank if I did not say I do not believe that we as a nation, our allies, are doing enough.
The governor of California, Earl Warren, had yet to indicate his position on the debate. We called Governor Warren and asked him, as a result of the testimony of MacArthur, Marshall, and Bradley thus far, what conclusions had he been able to reach? This was the governor's reply.
It is a sad spectacle for most Americans, I am sure, to see our greatest soldiers publicly disputing not only foreign policy, but military strategy and soldierly conduct as well. Our enemies must gain comfort from it, and the morale of our own fighting forces cannot be improved by it. However, I have reached the conclusion that the acrimony and resulting confusion should not discourage us. It has served at least one good purpose. It has refocused the attention of millions of Americans on our international problem. It has demonstrated that we as a nation are confronted with great global problems and with corresponding responsibilities. The testimony to date must have convinced most people of the old saying that no matter how thin you make a pancake, there are always two sides to it. Eliminate the personalities engaged in the debate, erase the partisan bitterness which it has engendered, and one finds a core of discussion that can lead to a straightforward and clear-cut declaration of American foreign policy. And more than that, a declaration that can be understood by the American people, because at long last, they will have had the facts. Certainly, the Senate hearings to date give us reason not only to expect, but to demand that the contesting forces will soon join together in formulating a unified foreign policy.
The two men most likely to meet in the 1952 finals both spoke this week, Harry Truman and Bob Taft. Each spoke about the other, but without mentioning any names.
It is with tremendous pride and with unbounded appreciation of his valor and his love of country that I present to you the world's greatest statesman and the next president of the United States, Senator Robert A. Taft.
Senator Taft spoke in Dayton, surprised no one by saying he would run if nominated, then spoke of the problems we face.
I believe the Democrats themselves came to the conclusion that if they were going to have to face the people of this country in 52 on the domestic issues, they were going to lose. I don't say that they deliberately turned the whole tendency of the present Congress to the foreign issue. Certainly that is the effect of what they've done. Perhaps they were forced into it. But in any event, today, in all probability, in 1952, we face a campaign on foreign policy, primarily. They have at least succeeded, whether deliberately or otherwise, in diverting the public attention from the domestic issues where the Republican Party has certainly secured today a majority support from the people, and they have presented to us the foreign issue.
President Truman spoke on Thursday morning, had prepared for delivery a rather routine speech on the domestic economy. But just before airtime, he discarded much of his typewritten text and ad-libbed.
A suggestion was made by one senator the other day that we ought to cut down the goal for our armed forces by 500,000 men. And this same senator wants to go for an all-out war in China all by ourselves. At a time like this, such a cut would be foolish. Not only foolish, it would be most dangerous. Slashing the size of our armed forces would not be economy. It would be an invitation to war. Let me drive that home. What we are attempting to do now, in the next year and a half, we anticipate may cost about $60 billion. 1 week of all-out war would cost from 10 to 20 times that. We must have friends in this troubled world. Yet some senators and some other people would have us go it alone. In this world of ours, in this day, we can't go it alone. There's a free world and there's a slave world. We belong to the free world and we are the head of the free world, and we've got to accept that responsibility and carry out that responsibility.
In Pennsylvania, Harold E. Stassen stated that he thought the hearings going on in Washington might be quite academic in the long run.
The answers in the great MacArthur debate over Korean-Chinese policy will not come from the battle of questioning in Washington. The answers will come from the battlefields of Korea. If the war in Korea quiets down, or a ceasefire or settlement is worked out soon, sentiment will swing to support President Truman's administration. But if the fighting continues in an endless, bloody loss of American lives, public opinion will insist upon the adoption of General MacArthur's program.
Who is ready?
If the war in Korea was nearing its end, it was news to the men on the 120-mile line. You are listening to A Gun Position, as this howitzer pounds round after round into the advancing human sea, which this week again began to attack.
Still hear that shell hissing through the air. A huge cloud of smoke and dust has now risen from the ground surrounding the...
One of the most powerful and concentrated artillery walls in history stood blocking the second big communist offensive of the last 30 days. These guns and our planes, our mines, our artillery, and our barbed wire caused thousands of enemy deaths. But the Chinese, in their fashion, kept marching over their own dead, pushing into our lines. A South Korean division fell back before them, and the Chinese split an American division, trapped some of its elements. Censorship from the front is holding up the full story. But tonight we know some of these men fought their way to safety in the South. Others are still fighting their way out. So far, the enemy has not thrown his full strength into battle. The action is concentrated on the East and East Central Front. We are waiting for a new blow in the West, in the Seoul area. And all along the line, where they are not tonight under communist attack, United Nations troops are ready for whatever the communists can throw at them. In one of the thousands of valleys of South Korea, our reporter, Jack Jefferson, turned on his recording machine. Here, there was no tremendous artillery fire, no boom of gun and zoom of plane. Here, there was an enemy attack and quiet. An American battalion somewhere in South Korea at 4 a.m.
One of our battalions is receiving a bonsai attack. We have lost telephone communication with one company and maintaining it by radio.
An hour later, and the correspondent, like the soldier, waits and wonders.
Just a few more hours now until daylight. It is growing lighter out, but the fog and rain is still pressing in on us in this little valley. The danger, while it is not past, certainly the end of the pitch blackness is a little more easing on the nerves.
Our planes are grounded. Our guns are having difficulty finding targets because of the weather.
The long night is at last over. And though the visibility is good, I believe the regiment will soon be on the move and we will get our CP out of this narrow valley surrounded by hills.
And now, 3 hours after the attack, this regiment prepares to do its day's work.
Tanks are being moved up to the two companies under the Banzai attack.
So it is all along the front. The fanatical enemy attacking and dying to the sound of his own cymbals in some sectors, and the quiet, watchful waiting in others. The enemy casualty toll in these past few days has been very heavy. We are given no indication thus far of our own losses. But from Generals Ridgway and Van Fleet today came these words: "We have met the first test. There will be more. The enemy attempt to destroy us will be futile." In Chicago, where in the fall of 1942 the atom age had its birth, there was this week on the campus of the same university another important event in the history of the atom.
The University of Chicago today dedicates these institutes to the progress and strength of the nation.
That was an official of the University of Chicago as he dedicated the new $11 million atomic research laboratories. We took our microphones into the Accelerator building, which houses the world's most powerful atom smasher, a synchrocyclotron capable of delivering 450 million volt atomic punch. We wanted to see this new $2.5 million monster gadget, which will provide basic research information on the structure of matter, information upon which future developments for peace or otherwise depend. A big, slow-moving elevator carried us underground into a concrete and steel-walled basement called the Experimental Pit. We were met by Dr. Herbert Anderson, who directed the building of the synchrocyclotron.
The cyclotron itself is a very large machine. It consists of a large electromagnet whose weight is 2,200 tons, about the same weight as a destroyer. In addition to the magnet, there is a high-frequency oscillator similar to those which are used in television broadcasting.
The cyclotron is a sort of atomic slingshot that whirls fragments of atoms in a giant circle and throws them at terrific speed at other metals or gases. The result can be atomic fission, a small-scale replica of the fission which goes on in the atomic bomb. We walked around the machine and picked up the sounds of the auxiliary equipment.
This is the oil circulating device that circulates oil around the bearing of the rotary condenser, which is inside the machine. This pump room supplies the mechanical vacuum to back the main vacuum pumps and also houses the 1,000 kilowatt motor generator set.
The cyclotron eats up enough power to light a city of 50,000 people. Dr. Anderson gave the order to start up the cyclotron while we listened.
Now, this door weighs 70 tons and separates the space where the cyclotron is and where the experiments are carried on. The purpose of the door is to close the passage between the two places and thereby protect people working with the meson beam from the dangerous radiation issued from the cyclotron. I'll press the button and start this door closing. We've got the door now closed now, and if everyone is out of the cyclotron chamber, we'll be able to turn on the beam. Mr. Cornbuth, will you turn on the beam? The warning bell. In 30 seconds, the high voltage will be turned on the oscillator.
When that steady bell becomes intermittent, the world's most powerful cyclotron will be manufacturing 450 million volts of atomic force.
Here comes the beam. The beam is on now. The intermittent bell means that the beam is on.
Within the actual cyclotron, only the ringing of the bell and complete quiet as the pale, luminous beam goes to work. With the same kind of silence and hope that accompanied that first man-made chain reaction on that same college campus 9 years ago.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is program 23 on Hear It Now. A full-hour review of the week's news told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
90 years ago, an event vital to the future of the great state of Pennsylvania took place. This week, a United States senator and a congressman paid tribute to that event, which happened at Lititz 90 years ago.
Mr. Speaker, today we celebrate the creation of what has virtually become a national institution. The American pretzel is 90 years old this month. Never sneer at the pretzel. Never discount its impact on the economy of the nation.
That was Congressman Paul B. Daigle. In the U.S. Senate, Senator James Duff of Pennsylvania handed them to his colleagues at lunch.
Whenever you have good pretzels, you can bet this. They're either Pennsylvania pretzels or they copy Pennsylvania pretzels.
In the town of Lititz, where it all began, there was an entire day set aside for rededication.
I am honored indeed and pleased as a representative of the government of the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to come with you today and dedicate this plaque that marks the place where the first commercial pretzel was baked in America. The pretzel is as typically Pennsylvania Dutch as the people who make it. It is not only nourishing, but it gives a salty tang to our diet that lifts it out of the ordinary routine of things.
I would like to say to everybody, particularly the children, that if you line up here in an orderly fashion, you'll all receive some pretzels. Now, no crowding. No crowding. I'm just trying to count it.
In the state of Florida, still trying to make the findings of the Kefauver Committee pay off, there was confusion and bewilderment of another sort. If your husband lost some money to a bookie on a bet, you could collect from the bookie. According to a new law now officially in the Constitution of the state of Florida, Representative John Bollinger, who wrote the law, explains it.
This new law in Florida provides that any person who loses money or property in an illegal gambling transaction may sue the winner within 90 days and recover his losses. It also provides that the state of Florida will receive an equal amount of money or an equal amount of the value of the property lost. In effect, this means when the loser sues, that the gamblers will have to pay back the amount they win, plus an equal amount which will go to the state of Florida. The law further provides that if the loser or his legal guardian does not sue within 90 days, then the wife or husband or any relative of the loser or relative of the loser's wife or husband may bring the suit. Under this law, if a husband or wife spends the grocery money for gambling and the children are without proper food and clothing as a result of gambling activities on the part of the husband or the wife, the other party to the marriage can sue the winner and recover the losses, with the state of Florida receiving an equal amount.
New York enforcement officers, bookmakers, and a few courageous housewives would watch the experiment in Florida. Some years ago, Fiorello LaGuardia discovered that there was a similar law in the books of the state of New York. The little flower had little luck in trying to enforce it. In New York City, one of the 9 Supreme Court justices made a speech.
People in Asia are dying of hunger, and the best-selling books in America are How to Get Thin.
That was the voice of Mr. Justice William Douglas, who, like many another American, is worried that the horseman, starvation, now riding the fields of India, may be communism's best recruiting officer for 1951.
In India last year, I saw thousands upon thousands dying. In a few places, the dead were so thick, along the roads, that the vultures could not eat them.
Last January on this program, we spent considerable time on the problem of wheat for India. Last week in Delhi, they cheered the communists when a member of parliament announced that Russia had several boatloads of wheat on the way. Still, no word from Washington. Justice Douglas is concerned that we are losing a battle almost as vital as Korea.
The tides are running fast against America in Asia. We are becoming in the hinterland of the world symbols of that which we despise at home. We are identified in Asia with practices and policies that are opposed to what we espouse at home. Only those who have traveled the villages of Asia can know the alarming trends that are underway there. I hesitate to say this, but it is clear to me that if in the years ahead we play in Asia the role we have played in the last 5 years, Asia will become united in one great crusade, a crusade against America. That would be a needless thing, a senseless one, and deeply tragic.
On Sunday, July 2nd, 1950, the Tigers and Cardinals were in first place. The price of food had reached a 2-year high. Everyone was humming the Third Man theme, and Betty Davis got her divorce in Mexico. On this same Sunday, the North Koreans were still pouring across the Han River, and a young captain named Frank Stilo, along with many more, was being flown into combat from Japan. After 10 months in the line with the 24th Infantry Division, Captain Stilo has come home. 11,000 others who wanted to come home, too, won't make it. They're dead. Tomorrow, on Armed Forces Day, the speakers will tell us about duty and sacrifice, courage and suffering. Tonight, on the eve of Armed Forces Day, we choose to honor the men and women in service not by any speech of our own, for no words of ours could tell the story you're about to hear. When we heard that Captain Stilo was coming home to Metuchen, New Jersey, with the first of the rotation combat personnel, we asked the captain and his wife for permission to stay in their shadow with our recorders. We promised to use the smallest, most inconspicuous equipment we could get. They were reluctant, but understanding. So in these closing minutes, this is what our recorders picked up. The homecoming of Frank Stilo, radio officer, 24th Infantry Division, serial number 0429738. Last place of residence, Korea. The boat trip home was a little better than the trip over. The ship swung lazily into Seattle's port of embarkation. Stateside boats gave their salute. There was the inevitable parade. The usual formalities.
I welcome you to Fort Lawton, as well as back to the United States. It is our purpose to get you on your way home.
The usual red tape.
Just 20 copies of your order, sir. You don't know it, Cass, but this green card to the end of the line for you, sir.
A little progress.
Captain Stilo, you are leaving Seattle on Northwest Airlines Stratocruiser flight number 10 at 10:15.
Much more progress.
This evening, Captain.
And the end, almost, of the line.
Your attention, please. Northwest Airlines announces the arrival of flight number 10, Stratocruiser service. Seattle, Tacoma, Spokane.
Frank had called his wife from Seattle. He hurried to a phone at Idlewild Airport to check in.
Hello?
Hello, dear.
Oh, hello, darling. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Did you just get in?
Yes, I'm at Idlewild.
Oh, that's wonderful. Gee, ever since you called last night, I've lived a thousand miles.
How are you?
Oh, I'm okay.
Good. How's the baby?
Oh, he's fine.
Good. Well, I'll be home shortly.
It's been the longest day.
I know it has.
Well, okay. Well, listen, dear. When you approach the baby, approach
Okay, dear.
Okay, darling.
Bye, dear.
See you soon, huh?
Yes, I will. Bye.
It seemed that Frank's motorcade of a single car would never get to Metuchen. But at last, it swung up the red clay road, stopped in front of a modest green shingled ranch-type house, and the returning hero was greeted by a dog he hadn't seen since he was a pup, a wife he hadn't seen since she left Japan 6 months ago, and a baby he had never seen.
Hi, Annie. Hello.
Hello, darling. Oh, I'm so glad to see you.
How are you, baby?
Oh, this is so wonderful.
You're looking great.
Oh, I've waited so long for this.
How's the baby?
Oh, he's fine.
Let's go in and see him.
Marie is a pleasant, attractive, dark-haired girl, born and raised in the South. She pushes the white front door open, her hand locked in Frank's.
Now approach him very slowly, mm-hmm. because he's, it'll frighten him.
Oh, it won't frighten him.
Hello, Glenn.
Hello, boy.
Aren't you going to say something
say
to Daddy?
Something. Mm-hmm. Hello, boy. Come on, boy. Come on. That's the big boy. Isn't he cute? Look at him. Now, where's all your hair? Where's all your hair?
He's got plenty of hair.
Aren't you going to talk to Daddy?
Glenn sits excited in an overstuffed tapestry chair, listens while Frank calls his mother in New York.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Mother.
Who's calling?
This is Frank.
Frank?
Yes.
Oh, gee, when did you get home?
I just arrived.
I can't believe it. Are you really home?
Yes, I am.
I'm so excited. I don't know what to say. I can't believe it.
Well, look,
are you all right?
I'm fine. Are you going to come out tonight?
I'm just catching the first train and get there. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I will.
Oh.
I'll have to hitchhike.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, give me a call when you arrive at the station. I'll pick you up.
I certainly will. Oh, I can't believe it. Are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine. Okay, Mother.
Okay, bye. Lots of luck.
Bye.
It's almost dinner time, but Joe Costa, mayor of Metuchen, New Jersey, population 10,000, has just heard that Frank is home.
Boy, it sure must be a wonderful feeling to be back home again.
Oh, yes, it certainly is.
Must have been quite a thrill for you, boy, to have seen that youngster for the first time.
Yes, it was, Joe. I really got the greatest thrill of my life when I saw the boy. He's quite a boy.
I know what you mean, because way back there when I got out of the Army back in 45, I saw my little boy for the first time. And when I saw that little guy, I get quite a thrill. You expect him to see a square head and all out of shape, but boy, when you see him, he's the most beautiful thing you think there is in this world. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I can vouch for that, Joe.
Well, Frank, I know that your doorstep's been worn out today, so that I think I better take leave now and give you a little time to spend some happy moments with your family. Good night, Frank.
Oh, good night, Joe. Glad to see you and hope you come around again.
Thanks, Frank.
Bye.
By 8 o'clock, the family starts filling the living room. One guess what they're talking about.
I think he's remarkable the way he... started to goo-goo and ga-ga all over his
yeah,
dad.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, that's the first time he ever said dada. All these months I've been drilling. Oh, there's a car coming in the drive now, Frank. Maybe that's Mother now.
Yes, I think you ought to go out and see.
It is her.
A mother and her son together again.
That's really you? Oh, just you're looking grand. Oh, my sweetheart. Oh, my sweetheart. I just love to look. This, I can't believe it's you, sweetheart.
Hello, Mom. How are you?
Oh, gee, it's really you, sweetheart. That's the way I feel. I can't even say anything. Oh, my sweet.
It's good to see you again.
After so many years, I think it is. I can't believe you're here, sweet.
Next morning, the Stylos have breakfast. Frank, Marie, and, of course, the general of the household in his privileged sanctuary. Little brown-eyed Glenn in his high chair.
Come on, baby. Come on, boy. Eat your breakfast.
He's watching you put every mouthful in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to have breakfast in your own home again?
Oh, it feels fine. Only it's the same old cooking.
Same old cooking? What do you mean by that statement? This is fresh orange juice. I know you liked it, so I fixed it. I had good intentions of making waffles this morning, but since we were up so late last night, I didn't get around to mixing them.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't he something the way he sits up?
Come on, say something, boy.
Glenn.
Say something, boy.
You're gonna have
you can't have the spoon.
Daddy,
huh? You can't have the spoon.
Give him a spoon of pie. As long as he doesn't poke it down his mouth. Here, darling.
That a boy. Sure is a nice day today, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a beautiful day.
Mm-hmm. We have any plans?
Well, I imagine people will be dropping in all day.
That's what I mean. We can get away from here.
we'll cut off all the lights and lock the door and just...
No.
We're not home.
Wouldn't you like to go someplace special?
Well, what I really had in mind, since we're so close to New York, I'd like to sort of relive our honeymoon.
How about the baby, though?
Oh, now that's the problem. I don't like to leave him with a babysitter. In fact, I never have. Mrs. Willoughby next door, she's a registered nurse. You haven't met her yet. Maybe I'll call her and see if she's busy.
Okay, well, why don't you do that, and we'll get everything settled, and we'll take off and...
I haven't been any place to shop because I didn't have anyone to leave the baby with.
Uh-oh, there goes the spoon.
It's 10 o'clock, a beautiful day. Frank and Marie roll out their black Studebaker and drive around town.
This car is sure built up. There used to be an old house. Oh, there's the old house behind the store.
Yeah.
They built all these stores around it.
This was just about finished when I arrived here.
Uh-huh. They have a pastry shop and... radio shop, television shop.
Yeah.
I see the old American Legion Hall hasn't changed any.
No, it's the same old place. That'll never change.
Frank gets ready for a big evening. Gets his hair cut at D'Amato's barber shop on Main Street.
So what's new around town?
Nothing much, same old story.
Mm-hmm. I notice that town has expanded quite a bit. They have new buildings and...
Oh, they moved the other end of town now. They're starting to... got that big national store up there on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
Four or five more new stores.
Well, 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 look
Hello,
who's
Jimmy.
Here.
How are you, Jimmy?
Oh, Frankie. When'd you come in?
Oh, I got here yesterday.
How's the fellow been in state again?
Oh, it feels wonderful.
But what'd you do? They send you back to get a good haircut?
That's right.
Boy. How long are you going to stay now?
Well, I'll be around here for about 30 days.
You going back again, or are you?
Oh, I've been reassigned to Georgia.
Well, by God, it's good to see you. I'm telling you.
Glad to see you.
Jimmy D'Amato knew Frankie when he was just a little kid. We took him aside and asked him to tell us about it.
I remember Frankie since he was 3 years old. I've been cutting his hair ever since. I'm telling you, he was the best kid in Touchins. Never cried. Like these kids over here, sometimes they get you so nervous to give him a haircut, but there's something about Frankie, he never cried. In fact, sometimes I had to pinch him to make him move. He was so quiet in the chair. Of course, at the end, you know, to make him feel good, I used to go out and buy him a lollipop.
A few blocks up from the barber's, on the same side of Main Street, is Mario's restaurant, the classiest place in town. Frank has known Mario Gianvito a long time.
Well, Frank, I'm glad to see you.
Hello, Mario. How are you?
How are you, Frank?
Good. Glad
How
to
you
see
been?
You. Oh, I'm fine. How are you?
I bet you had a tough time out there. I'm glad to see you back.
Oh, it wasn't too bad. Glad
well,
to be back.
That's very nice. I hope some of these days we'll have a little time together and go out and catch a few trout.
Yeah, how is he fishing, by the way?
Well, this has been pretty good.
Good.
Really, been told me they've been catching quite a few trout. I haven't got too much time myself.
Have you done any fishing in Pennsylvania lately?
Yes, done a little, not too much. But I hope you have a little time sometime next week. We might go out and have a trip together.
I think we can arrange it. I'm anxious to get my equipment out and do a little fishing.
Oh,
been quite some time since I've...
That'll be wonderful. I think it'll really be very good.
Marie is almost dressed, ready to start for New York. Then the phone rings. Someone has read about Frank in the papers.
Honey, telephone. Louis Miller calling from Brooklyn.
Okay, dear, I'll take it.
A family anxiously looks for new hope. This wasn't the first call like this.
This is Captain Stylo.
Yes?
Uh-huh. Was his name Miller also?
Yeah, it was Hank Miller.
Hank Miller.
Yeah, he was a
club. Uh-huh. Do you know what company he was in?
I can't remember.
I see. If he was reported missing, there's a good possibility that he may be a prisoner, but that's very difficult to say. Yeah, well, I could appreciate your feelings. I'm sorry I couldn't help you.
Thank you very much, Captain.
Okay. Right, bye.
The captain and his bride check in at the Pierre, just as they did on the day they were married. And then, as now, Frank forgets nothing.
Oh, hello, dear.
Hello, dear. How are you?
Alexa, sir?
Yes. I have a present for you.
No wonder you wanted to go out alone.
Yes, here.
Well, you'll have to open it. I'm too nervous to open it. Oh, it's beautiful. It's white, too. It goes grand with what I'm wearing. Oh, I'm afraid you'll have to pin it on for me. I can't remember whether to go up or down. It's been so long since I had one.
Okay, dear. Let me get this pin out, and I'll pin it on for you. Let's see. Does this thing go up or down?
I think that's right. That's okay.
Fine. What do I get for it?
Oh, you want something in return, huh?
Sure do.
The second honeymoon begins at the same table in the cotillion room up against the wall. Only this time, the pink flowers on the table look a little brighter.
I have a question. Maybe you won't answer, but how do you feel? Do you feel the same way as you did when we first were married?
Well, I feel a little more on the domestic side.
What do you mean, domestic side?
Well, little Glenn makes that, I don't know, he brings that side in. You'll realize it in time to come.
Well, I realize it, but I don't feel any older than I did the day we got married. As a matter of fact, I feel younger.
Oh, I don't feel like that much time has elapsed either, but, I don't know. Becoming a mother has made me realize an awful lot.
They dance, and they eat, and they talk.
Are you enjoying yourself, dear?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. The brochure is wonderful, too, and oh, she sings so beautifully.
She is very pretty.
Oh, you would think so. I wonder if we could request our very special tune, you know, the one that played the wedding.
Yes, I think we can arrange that. I'll ask the captain to request it for us.
Oh, that would be wonderful. You do that, huh?
I will.
Oh, she's lovely.
Stanley Melba plays the Stylo's song, Always. This time they sit, they smile, and they dream, and they remember. And there's nothing they can say to each other that can be put into words, or that each doesn't already know. Marie always wanted to go to the Stork Club, never got around to it. This time, they make it. Sherman Billingsley, who owns the Stork, spots the captain with his ribbons, Bronze Star, Presidential Unit Citation, and comes over to the table.
Well, you see Mary Martin up there. And Pinzer's at the next table. You know him.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And that man sitting at the across the way is Leonard Lyons.
Uh-huh.
And too bad you didn't come in a little early. A little earlier, I should say. Dorothy Kilgallen was here, and Morton Downey and Faye Emerson. I'll tell you what we'll try to do. We'll see if we can get Pinzer and Mary Martin to come back and say hello to you before you leave.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
We'd like
we'd
to meet them very much.
Everyone should be very happy to come back and shake hands with you.
We'll be very happy to shake hands with them.
The introductions.
I don't have to introduce you. Captain Stylo, Mrs. Stylo.
Very,
Mary,
very
glad
nice
to know you.
Miss Stylo.
Hello, Mr. Pinzer. So happy to know you.
Didn't we see your picture in the paper?
Polish them
yes,
up.
You did.
And the baby's picture?
That's right.
Yes.
Oh, wasn't that fun?
Oh, that picture is perfect.
Well, now, did you just see the baby that time?
Yes, for the first time.
Oh.
That was the first time he'd ever seen me.
How old is the baby?
He was 6 months old the day his father arrived.
Oh, how fun.
And he said, Dad, Dad, for the first time, too.
Oh, did he really?
But I had been drilling it into him for months, you know.
You know, Ezio has...
I have one of 5 months today.
She
is 5 months today.
Well, congratulations.
If he hadn't gone to Korea, he would have been more in Japan.
But wasn't he impressed with you?
Well, I believe
he was. What did he do? Just say, Daddy?
Well, he played with his toys and kept gurgling.
First, he wondered. He looked at me, and he wondered he's...
I wonder that really
who
my
he
father?
Is.
We have a little girl, November 4th.
Oh, good.
So it's a good month. November 4th.
Or November 5th.
Really?
Oh, good.
My third son.
Really?
Fine.
They'll keep you busy. But
when he walked in, I said, "You take over. I'm going to bed. I need a rest."
Where are you from?
Well, Maria's from the South, and it's from South Carolina.
Oh, where's your Southern accent?
No,
she lost it in Japan.
She did, didn't she?
Maybe to the South Koreans or
something. I'm more Southern than she is. Well, it's awfully nice to meet you.
That would be
nice
swell.
To see
you.
Thank
you for coming over.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night,
Captain.
Glad
to meet
you.
Good night.
Good night.
Baby Glenn will be up early as usual, and then there's the babysitter. But this second honeymoon ought to end the way it began. So they stop on Route 1 at a place they remember well.
Boy, it's been a long day today, honey.
I enjoyed it so much. Let's hope that we'll have many more of these days.
I hope so, too.
What time is it?
Oh, let's see. It's 4 o'clock.
4 a.m.?
That's right, 4 a.m. in the morning.
Gee, I didn't realize it was so late. No wonder I'm so tired.
Let's drink our coffee and then we'll head for home.
This is the end of our story of Captain Stilo's homecoming. He'll spend a few more days in Metuchen, see a few more friends, have a few more moments like those you've just heard, and then he'll move on. Captain Stilo, radio officer, 24th Infantry Division, serial number 042-9738, has served his country in the best way he knows how. We join with the captain's neighbors in welcoming him home. And on the eve of Armed Forces Day, those of us who cling to comforts, share no risks, seek refuge in words, and often forget that there is no substitute for courage, would pay our small tribute to the fallen and to those who still fight in the most eloquent manner permitted by radio. A little silence.
When you've been away from home a long time, it's difficult to put into words. How can you tell anyone how it feels? Sometimes you wonder if you'll ever get home again. And then it happens. You're home. Your wife, your baby, everything you've been wanting and dreaming about, suddenly it's real. It's yours. And you're back home again.
You have just heard program 23 in the CBS series, Hear It Now, a document for air based on the week's news. Hear It Now is edited and produced by Edward R. Murrow and Fred W. Friendly, and a CBS staff which includes John Aaron, Jesse Zausmer, Irving Gitlin, Edmund Scott, and Joseph Wershberg. Portions of the program originated at WTOP Washington, WHIO Dayton, WCAU Philadelphia, WRVA Richmond, WTAL Tallahassee, WHP Harrisburg, KIRO Seattle, KROY Sacramento, and WBBM Chicago. Combat recordings in Korea were made by CBS correspondent John Jefferson. Edward R. Murrow can be heard over most of these same CBS stations Monday through Friday at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Olin Tice speaking.
Today, more than ever, your security and that of your country are closely linked. For your own security as well as America's, buy more United States defense bonds. Buy them regularly and often. Defense bonds are one direct way you can make America strong and fight a successful battle against inflation. Purchases of United States defense bonds help make America strong. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.